Hello and welcome to Hindsight. Sharon Davis with you. The title of this weekly history program, the word hindsight, suggests that the past is something we look back to see. And much of history works exactly that way, peering at the records of times gone by in order to get a picture of the past, to render it visually. But seeing is only one way of experiencing, imagining a time, place and context. And in the past 20 years, a new school of history has emerged which uses sound as the key interpretive tool. Today we put an ear to some of the work of Australian historians whose explorations into sound history and sonic archaeology take us to the slave plantations of 19th century North America and to the exploratory expeditions of colonial Australia. Hearing the Past is produced by Jennifer Bowen.
Once upon a time, people spoke in distant voices and listened with invisible ears.
I don't know what my earliest memory of sound would be.
I think the first sounds I can remember hearing would be my parents' voices.
The sound of the pin dropping on my father's record player, and we had to sit, you know, back from it so that we didn't disturb it.
Well, I was brought up in the country, so noises were, thinking about it, more colourful.
Water on the rooftop.
Just the wind through a cypress tree that was in my front yard.
The milk cart coming early hours of the morning.
Let us determine the facts about sound and hearing.
People have always been interested in sound. Medieval philosophers discussed sound. They were interested in how sound was propagated, how it was generated, the physiology of listening.
Sound is heard in air, and also in water, though less so. Aristotle, De Anima, Book 2, Chapter 8.
There's a continuity in the interest in sound among contemporaries, but historians have been relatively slow to pick up on the interest in the role of sound in the production of history, partly because I think there has been a long-standing assumption about the power and the authenticity and authority of the eye.
In any given language, there are different levels of auditive sensitivity. English has a relatively low level of auditive sensitivity. In English, most forms of knowledge and opinion are framed in visual terms. So we might call something a reading, even though it's actually a piece of music. Perspectives, visions, all of the words that we use for knowledge, or reliable or respectable knowledge, are likely to be expressed in visual terms. Words that express unreliable information, on the other hand, are nearly always expressed in sonic terms. Gossip, tittle-tattle, chatter, whinging, rumour, lip service, scolding, nagging, prattle, Chinese whispers. All of these are telling us that we do not have a high respect for sonic information.
We're having to search around for new words as we write the history of sound, most of which are kind of piggybacked on to visual metaphors.
My name is Shane White. I'm a professor of history at the University of Sydney, and I work in African American history.
Shane White has used in his work both written records as well as tape recordings. Of particular interest have been a number made in the 1930s, part of an 11th hour project in America to save the singing and speech of former slaves.
I frequently collaborate with another historian associated with the history department there, Graham White, who is not related to me at all. It became strikingly obvious to us that because it was illegal for slaves to learn how to read or write, black culture was designed to be spoken out loud. whole thrust of it was towards sound. So we thought it would be interesting to look at that, not just look at the obvious, which is music, and everyone today is aware of the extent to which everything from rap, hip-hop, blues, jazz, in part derives from the African-American past, but also the sounds of other things. What the sounds of the plantation were like in the South, what the sounds of urban living were like. Slavery starts in America in the 17th century, and this classic period of slavery that today is best known through Gone with the Wind is 19th century slavery. In the 18th century, slavery is hugging the eastern seaboard, so the main places are Virginia and South Carolina. In 1793, with the invention of the cotton gin, there's this cotton boom that spreads out across the South from South Carolina and very, very rapidly spreads across as far as Texas. And this becomes the plantation South. There are millions of slaves. Again, we have the Gone with the Wind image of a huge plantation with, you know, 200 slaves on it. That was relatively unusual. Only a few like that. Most plantations were rather small, you know, 8-10 slaves. There's the sounds of work on a plantation. The hollers in which they called out to one another in the field were very, very expressive, even though there were no words in them. The sounds of horses, the sound of livestock, and the sounds of everything from the, you know, the blacksmith shop to the sound, the agricultural sounds of, you know, cutting sugar cane or bringing cotton in, putting it in the cotton press. And then there's the sounds linked to slavery itself, the sounds made by the whites. The sounds of whippings are the most obvious things that have come down to us in slave memories. The sound of a whip cutting into flesh and the screams of slaves. And with that, you could include things like the sound of hound dogs. Hound dogs are associated with chasing down runaway slaves.
Slaves were whipped, they were branded, they were beaten, but oddly enough, and interestingly enough, that particular representation is something that enters the abolitionist dialogue.
Mark Smith is Professor of History at the University of South Carolina. He's led the way in the study of sound history, particularly with a book called Listening to 19th Century America. In it, he argues for the significance of the ways, the contested ways, in which the North and South heard each other prior to the Civil War.
The abolitionists in the North, their intention was to abolish slavery. And one of the things that they picked up on was the sounds of punishment, the sounds of cruelty. And in their abolitionist tracts, beginning in the 1830s, they not only visually described the cruelty to slaves, but they really played on the acoustomology of cruelty. And one of the reasons that they did this is because at the same point in time, the North was moving away from physical punishment. They were establishing prisons. And one of those prison systems was called the silence system. And the silence system was designed to silence prisoners, a kind of penance, so that they had to hear their own sin. There were a variety of silent system prisons in Philadelphia and Boston where prisoners could hear only themselves. The guards would walk around with slippers on. The pipes connecting the different cells were wrapped and swaddled in sound-absorbing material. So when the abolitionists hear the South, what do they hear? They hear backwardness. They hear barbarity. And they hear it principally in the form of slave whipping. And they also hear it in the form of slave chains. The clank of the chain is a very powerful metaphor. And in fact, some abolitionists, when they were talking in the North, would begin their speech to the abolitionist audiences by asking for quiet and then loudly dropping a chain onto the stage. And they would say, that is the sound of slavery. So what we have are two different societies, partly a product of different political economies, that use sound to accentuate difference, that use sound to denigrate the other.
October the 1st, 1844. After having repaired some harness and after my companions had completed their arrangements, we left Jimba and launched buoyant with hope into the wilderness of Australia. Many a man's heart would have thrilled like our own had he seen us winding our way round the first rise beyond the station with a full chorus of God Save the Queen. Ludwig Leichhardt, 1844.
Sound is a profoundly cultural or social construction. People respond to sound according to the historical context that they're in.
Diane Collins is Associate Dean at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. She's undertaken research on the way Australia was experienced in sound at various times in the 19th century. On the goldfields in one study, in another, the oral experience of colonial explorers.
When Europeans first came to Australia, assumptions about sound were part of their cultural baggage, just as assumptions about table manners or attitudes to God were. They hear natural sound often through their religious perspective. They hear bird sound as an expression of divine order. They listen to cows mooing, and they hear social calm. They're very familiar with certain acoustic environments, and it's very unlike what they discover when they arrive in Australia.
We distinguished, during the rain, three different frogs, which made a very inharmonious concert. During the evening and the night, a short, bellowing noise was heard, made probably by kangaroos, of which Mr. Gilbert stated he had seen specimens standing 9 feet high. Ludwig Leichhardt, 1845.
Expeditions, when you start reading explorers' journals, become very vivid acoustic as well as visual journeys.
Among the reeds between the two rivers was a shallow lagoon, where swans and other wildfowl so abounded that, although half a mile from our camp, their noise disturbed us through the night. I therefore named this somewhat remarkable feature Swan Hill. Thomas Mitchell, June the 21st, 1836.
Well, there's a certain amount of literal reporting, but there's often a very metaphorical aspect to the way explorers use language about sounds. You often see this with bird calls, for example. You have Sturt in the Macquarie Marshes. He's battling his way across it. He hears the incessant tone of birds and frogs, and the way he interprets it is full of metaphor because he hears it as protest, an invasion of the sanctuary of these animals. Similarly, kookaburras calls. He doesn't find the kookaburra's laugh amusing. He finds it mocking that the bird is commenting on his misfortune.
At 7 miles, as we entered a forest, we heard the sound of the natives' hatchets. I thought it best to proceed quietly on our way. We heard calls in various directions. Thomas Mitchell, January the 8th, 1832.
Was sound actively used by explorers? Was that something that they would deploy in particular ways?
Yes, one of the obvious ways they used it is that conquest itself was voiced as well as mapped or written. When John McDill Stewart, for example, on each occasion when he reaches the centre, when he reaches Northern Australia, his party celebrate this moment with three long and hearty cheers. Explorers use this kind of acoustic gesture to control and claim the land as they move through it. They also use sound to envelop them in a kind of security. For example, expeditions took dogs along with them to alert them to any kind of intrusion in a camp. The animals on expeditions have bells attached to them. They tie bells to the stirrups of their horses so they could hear where each member of the party was. They protect themselves by using sound, and the most obvious example is gunfire. They use gunfire in many encounters with Indigenous Australians to intimidate them. It's much more the sound of the gun, the report, which explorers rely on.
I drew up the men in line and sent up a rocket, and the men gave three cheers, and all the blacks ran off. They hailed us afterwards from the wood, saying they were preparing to corroboree and inviting us to be present. We heard something like a beginning to the dance, but the hollow sounds they made resembled groans more than any sort of music. Thomas Mitchell, 1832.
Slaves understood the power of the herd world. The power of maintaining silence at particular moments in time. So, for example, when they would escape, they were very careful not to make noise. They were very careful to do it at certain times of the year. Winter was often hard to escape in because sound travelled farther. For lots of the enslaved in the South, the most powerful forms of resistance were non-audible. And I'll give you an example here. Slaveholders were very anxious to control the sonic soundscape of the plantation, and they didn't want slaves, after working hours, to be doing anything other than resting to work for the next day. And yet slaves had their own cultural imperatives, and they wanted to, for example, pray. So you have accounts from the slave narratives, evidence from slaves themselves, that they would sometimes hang wet blankets to be prayed into, thereby smothering the sound. And there was these very interesting examples of slaves praying into upturned pots, and pots that are half full of water. And when I first came across these examples in the slave narratives, I couldn't quite fathom what they meant, and I thought that initially it might have been mere superstition. So I did take the initiative, and I wrote to a chap at the Institute for Vibration Studies at the University of Southampton in the UK. He said, I suspect what's happening is that any sounds uttered into the pots would not be absorbed necessarily, but they would be thrown out in a more random way so that a hearer at a distance would hear something, but he wouldn't hear necessarily the human voice. It might sound more like a rustle, the sound of a tree, perhaps. In other words, it's a kind of masking effect. And we don't know how slaves knew this, how they understood this, but it crops up sufficiently in the slave narratives to suggest that they understood something about how to manipulate the soundscape of the plantation south to engage in worship without being heard and thereby not being caught.
On many of these plantations, blacks outnumber whites, and so the sonic landscape is filled by black sounds.
Because slaveholders were accustomed to what they liked to perceive as a very powerful form of mastery, this mentality extended to the sounds that were made on plantations. So they would encourage, for example, singing while slaves labored. This reinforced to slaveholders the conceit that slaves were in fact happy, that they were docile, that they were good laborers, but they were being taken care of too.
What does a slave owner want? He wants slaves who are doing work. And if they want to sing to one another, that's fine, as long as they work. And particularly when some of the songs, like work songs, actually help with the work, then they're quite enthusiastic.
No matter where they may be, or what they may be doing, indeed, whether alone or in crowds, at work or at play, ploughing through the steaming maize in the sultry heat of June, or bared to the waist with deft hand mowing down the yellow grain, or trudging homeward in the dusky twilight after the day's work is done. Always and everywhere they are singing. Daniel Robinson Hundley, 1860.
Much of our knowledge of African-American culture, in particular music and singing, comes from travellers who went into the South. They would often be from the North or from Europe, England, France, and it was the genre of the traveller account, and there are hundreds, in fact thousands of them published covering the period from 1800 down to 1860.
The man standing on the pile of firewood sang an improvised song in stanzas. The others joined in vigorous chorus.
It was the call and response pattern that was one of the things that many of them noticed, in which there's a call and then a response to that. So often when you have a group of people singing, there's a leader who calls out something and then the answer comes back musically. And this call and response pattern comes from Africa. In the 19th century, they're using English when they're singing it, but it is clearly derived from Africa, and it's familiar to many people today through blues and, to a lesser extent, jazz.
The whole scene was so accordant that it would have produced a fine effect upon any theatre whatever. Frederica Bremer, Mississippi, 1850.
In actual fact, I think it's probably a minority of whites who appreciated the sounds. Probably more common was a response of horror, that the sounds were barbaric. This could often lead to whites just shaking their heads and refusing to accept that there is anything in what they're listening to.
A strange, weird tune no white person's voice could ever follow. The odd turns in the throat, slurring or wavering between flat and natural. Incomprehensible, meaningless, monotonous, endless chants. Obscure syllables recurring constantly.
A white is after clear singing and a linear story. That's not important to the African Americans who are listening. They're listening for other things. They're listening for verbal dexterity, cleverness, playfulness, and rhythmic complexity. But for much of the period of slavery, I actually do think that in the case of music, there were different ways of listening, and the slaves and their owners are often listening for different things.
My Country by Dorothea McKellar.
Well, for an historian who's used to looking for evidence of what things look like, it's a new thing. It's something you really have to make an effort to do, to actually be aware of what things sounded like. If you're on your lookout, of course, you can find a lot of things in all sorts of evidence that aren't there for people who are asking different sorts of questions, I suppose. So it's a matter of asking the right sort of questions. What did Australia sound like? What were the things that struck people most about what the country sounded like? You can't answer those questions if you don't ask them in the first place.
Professor Alan Atkinson of the University of New England. He's written extensively on Australian history, increasingly on the sounds of everyday life and the voices of everyday people.
The first noises really that regulate social life in the settlement in Sydney were military noises more than anything else. The tattoo, for instance, the drum beats, which marked the beginning and end of each day and periodised the military life. We didn't have church bells, for instance, until, I don't know, perhaps the 1810s, 20s. Some of those sorts of noises, which are civilian noises, if you like, which are less familiar than the military noises to begin with. It's a military soundscape, I think, in that first 10 or 15, perhaps 20 years, until the free settlers start to come in, the clergy start coming in, and the regularities of civilian life, of village life, begin to overtake the regularities of military life. Settlement begins in 1788, and numbers of children born in the 1790s, increasing numbers, of course, and by the 1820s you have something like the sort of numbers which can sustain a kind of jargon, a language, certain kind of habits of speech, an in-speech, if you like. You can see that characterising the native-born by the 1820s, native-born being recognised by the kind of words, and not only the kind of words but the kind of accent they used as well. It's a kind of medley of convict-type language, particularly London Cockney language with Aboriginal words in it as well, and you can see this strangely jumbled kind of language. It might well have been a put-on kind of language to some extent, with native-born trying to show off their own distinctiveness by using certain terms. There was a certain kind of pride about being native-born, so that may well be that just as they wore certain things like cabbage tree hats, etc., they also used a certain sort of language in order to demonstrate they were native-born.
Africans brought to America as slaves brought with them not one, but tens of languages. Placed in disparate groupings and sold from one owner to another, they made English, or sometimes French, their language of communication.
This brother gone and Lord Sanam there and brother gone there.
The lowland Negro of South Carolina has a barbaric dialect. The English words seem to tumble all at once from his mouth and to get sadly mixed when he endeavors to speak.
The slave trade officially is no longer allowed into America from 1808, and really most slaves came into America before the Revolution, which is 1776 to 1783. By the time you get down to the 19th century, most slaves are American-born, and English is the language, but often it's a black English, so it differs slightly from English, which can have a disconcerting impact on white observers. Whites will often talk about the bad grammar of slaves talking. What in actual fact is happening, because there is a difference in the way many blacks spoke and sounded in the 19th century. The grammar is often obeying rules and laws that come from Africa.
Let your daughter up in the land place, see they're having a good job there. And you want to carry a son up there for you, want to see the...
It was a common academic view, well down to after World War II, that the way blacks spoke would be traced by linguists back to the way Cornish people spoke in England. Africa was seen not to have had any influence on African-American culture. The dominant view amongst historians, anthropologists, sociologists, down into the 1950s, was that Africa was wiped out the moment the slaves were ripped out of Africa and taken to the New World, and that the slaves in the New World were tabula rasa. They were blank slates on which whites, be they Spanish, Portuguese, or Puritans, imprinted their culture. One of the most revealing sources of slave life are a series of interviews conducted in the 1930s as part of the New Deal, in which people were employed to go around and find anyone in the South who was born and lived as a slave who was still alive and interview them about slavery. And there is some controversy about the fact that much of this stuff is rendered in dialects. One of my favourite pieces from these slave interviews was a former slave named Lorenzo Ezell, who made it clear to his interviewer exactly how he wanted his words to be put down on paper. And he said, "Be sure and put it because instead of because. 'Cause us didn't say because, us said because. Us didn't say then, us said den. Us said dem and does and dees and wid and hab and an and yusta and gwan, gana." And, of course, he was right to insist on those corrections. Nowadays, some scholars who use this material go through and silently correct it. I happen to disagree with that. This guy is very clear about the way he wants to be put down in speech.
Voice is the sound made by something with a soul. Although some things may be said to have a voice, for example the pipe, the lyre, and other things which lack a soul, but have variation in pitch, melody, and articulation, there is a likeness here because voice too has these properties. Aristotle, On the Soul, Book 2, Chapter 8.
We do have a very large number of treatises on oral presentation. We have guides to correct projection and enunciation. The study of rhetoric itself was originally the study of oratory.
Bruce Johnson is visiting professor of cultural theory at the University of Turku in Finland. He's been researching the politics and power implications of the voice.
Up until the ascendancy of print, and still afterwards but not to the same extent, the question of vocal communication was of great interest. Francis Bacon wrote about vocal communication. What's the best way to do business with people using your voice? It was a highly auditory era. With the arrival of print, we had a new information economy. And the ascendancy of print, or the consolidation of print as the medium of authoritative knowledge is marked very strongly by Samuel Johnson's English Dictionary in the 18th century.
I have attempted a dictionary of the English language. When I took the first survey of my undertaking, I found our speech copious without order and energetic without rules. Wherever I turned my view, there was perplexity to be disentangled and confusion to be regulated.
He made a conscious decision, which he talks about in his preface, to include only words that had been written down. He would not include words that had not been written down. And what this really meant was the languages that were used by the underclasses. Why were they not written down? Because many of the underclasses could not write. So Johnson really defined two kinds of linguistic community, those who could write and those who could not. And those who could not, that is, those who could only make sound, who could only speak, were relegated to a lower class of citizen.
Which it is the duty of the lexicographer to correct or prescribe.
The right to call a sound noise, as opposed to, say, information or music, is one of the ways in which we can trace power relations, certainly from the medieval period. Noise is not an objective entity. It's a value judgment we impose upon a particular kind of sound. It's the weed in the sound garden. Who decides what is noise and what is meaningful information tells us an enormous amount about the particular power relations at any given moment in a social formation.
You're listening to Hindsight. Today, hearing about the work of a number of historians who've set out to listen to the past. It's been a subject of considerable interest in North America, where the soundscape of slavery spoke loudly to the abolitionist North. The North itself was heard by the South, and they didn't like what they heard.
Anyone who walks the streets of New York with his eyes and ears open sees and hears many strange and horrid things. Poverty, sickness, filth, crime and wretchedness echo in one ear, while the silk rustles of the sashaying skirts of the ladies sound in the other.
People in the South were careful listeners, both literally and figuratively. Now, literally, when they travelled north, for example, to, say, New York City, what did they hear? What did they listen for? Well, what they heard was noise, as many of them understood it. They heard the noise of the mob, the noise of excessive democracy, the noise of industrialism, the noise of urbanism. It was the isms that they objected to most strenuously, because those isms were proxy for social dislocation in their own world, which is why they had resisted it so strenuously. But they also listened figuratively, because they read. And what did they read? Well, they read these travel accounts from other Southerners. And these travel accounts then circulated these acoustic stereotypes of Northern urbanism. And of course, it created a very clumsy image of the North, just as the North had a very clumsy acoustic image of the South. The North was not largely urban by 1860, it was largely rural, and some of those rural soundscapes in the North were not unlike those in the South. But we're talking about perceptions, and the way that that acoustic stereotype circulated rendered sectional identity quite concrete, so that people began to think that the entire slave South was wholly agricultural and the entire modernizing North was wholly urban. And it was those stereotypes, I think, that in a way fed the coming of the Civil War. It certainly misrepresented each region, but we often work on misrepresentations and they become real in and of themselves.
The South is known for being mostly rural. There are not that many cities as such in the South. But slavery didn't just exist in the South, it existed in the North, and there are large concentrations of slaves and also free blacks living in Charleston, Richmond, and places like that. It's a particularly interesting area, I think, for the sonic history. We have a number of different sources that point to the fact that in places like New Orleans, much of the sound of New Orleans was created by blacks, and there is this huge variety of black languages, blacks driving coaches and singing and talking and yelling, an incredible black life.
Black women, with huge baskets of rusks, rolls and other appurtenances of the breakfast table, crying in loud, shrill French their stock in trade, followed by milk criers and butter criers and criers of everything but tears.
It was not just black voices that made African-American sounds. There's a variety of other ways in which blacks could make sounds. Clapping, patting juba, keeping in time with your hands, clapping your hands together, clapping your hands against your body and your hands. There are improvised musical instruments, percussion in particular, you know, tin pots and all sorts of things are being used. Even something like whistling. There's this one wonderful account from the urban slave South, from Lynchburg in Virginia, in which someone actually wrote about the whistling that was going on in Lynchburg, and how as you were walking down the street, there were blacks lounging against the walls, sort of looking at whites as the whites were walking along the streets and whistling. And then just doing interesting little things with the pitch and with the volume of the whistling. Some whites, particularly white women, could feel intimidated as they're walking down the streets. And as well as this, there are groups of blacks who are doing whistling contests, cutting contests. Someone will whistle a bit of a rhythm and then someone else will embellish that rhythm. And it's a question to see who can do it the best. This is familiar to us through cutting contests in jazz nowadays. But blacks were doing this with their voices, whistling in the 1850s. You know, it's not as though whites couldn't and didn't whistle as well. But the way blacks did this and the way they introduced a competitive element into the cutting contest, they actually seized something like this and made it particularly African-American and could use it in order to claim and stake a claim to the actual space of the streets.
There's a large movement towards the end of the 19th century, which you can see also in Britain and the United States and other British colonies, to reform education, to make children into much more self-conscious citizens, to make them participate in the cultural life of the country rather more than had been the sort of emphasised earlier on. And participating in the cultural life of the country meant being able to speak, to use your voice in local politics and that sort of thing.
Once upon a time, a long time ago, children had to read aloud.
So there's an emphasis in this period on speech. And when they talked about reading, the need to teach children to read, very often, I mean, almost invariably, they meant reading out loud. And there's an enormous emphasis on the clarity and articulation with which you read out loud, sometimes even beginning to seem more important than actually understanding what you are reading. It's all about reading out loud and reading in a particular clear and correct fashion.
I love the sunburnt country, a land of sweeping plains, of ragged mountain ranges, of droughts and flooding rains. I love her.
So there's a new emphasis on oral articulation, what you sounded like in school. And that's linked in by the end of the 19th century with the new ideas about nationhood, that, OK, we're going to sound correct. Correct means sounding the same as everyone else. It's an index of nationality and national belonging and therefore of citizenship, that you should lose your connection with your class, your distinctive class, so you shouldn't sound working class, but even more perhaps, more important, you should lose your connection with little places within the nation so that the whole population belongs to the whole nation. All sounding alike was almost as important as all looking alike, the White Australia policy, which was obviously a much more famous aspect of Australian nationalism, but this idea of sounding the same was very important too. Sort of intimacy of uniformity, if you like. All of our voices coming out from our insides are similar. source material is very important. But there's also reports from school inspectors. The vastness of the educational bureaucracy in this period and the need to record everything means that you have very detailed accounts by school inspectors about how children sounded, whether they were dropping their H's or not in particular places, whether they'd stamped out the Cornish accent in the copper mining towns at Kapunda, etc. There's a new interest in geography as well, and a new capability in dealing with large spaces. And the idea of having a single large space, such as Australia, such as the British Empire, filled with voices of all the same sort, is fascinating. It's an intriguing possibility that you can encompass within a large expanse of the world that kind of uniformity. And I don't know, human beings love uniformity. When imagination fails, go for uniformity. And imagination frequently does fail. And that seems to be what's happening in the late 19th century.
Sound can define space. Sound can determine allegiance. But it's unavoidable that sound passes.
I remember hearing, when I was very little, the horses clopping down Rathmines Road delivering milk.
The clip-clop down the street, concrete street where I lived.
And it was a comforting sound.
Well, I lived in the country, and running down the road to school to catch the bus on a gravel road, which is now, you know, bitumen, you know, asphalt, whatever.
So running on a gravel road makes quite a particular sound, does it?
It does. But it's sort of a crunchy, noisy sound as you're pounding along.
You could make the case, well, you can't talk about the history of the past and the sound of the past without hearing it, but I'm not convinced. The written word was really the first recorder in many ways, and it captured not the sounds per se, but the meanings that people attach to sounds. And it is those meanings that I think are the most interesting things to excavate historically. And there's a real methodological problem here. Let's say it is technically possible to reproduce the sound of, say, a hammer hitting an anvil from 1800. What would that actually give us? Well, not really much. I mean, what we need to know is not the actual decibel level, although that's interesting. We don't really need to hear it again. What we need to know is what people at the time thought about that sound, how they interpreted that sound, the language they used to describe it, and the larger meaning attached to that sound. So just because you can't reproduce the actual sounds of the past, or at least in a pre-recorded era, doesn't mean that you can't get to grips with the sounds of the past.
Trying to recover sound history, the history of sound, is actually very difficult, because once a sound is made, it's gone forever. And sound can't be rendered that well onto the printed page. It actually is quite difficult. All those travellers who went through the South, some of them are extremely aware of the importance of sound and will write about it. Others appear to have been stone deaf. You know, there are people who go to Congo Square in New Orleans and write an account of it, and you think, please, couldn't you say something about the sound? Didn't you notice what was going on? So different sources are of different use on this, and making generalizations about the way sound is moving is fraught with difficulty.
There aren't any banjos here. There aren't any ocarinas. There's no riff-raff with a phonograph performing on concertinas. There's only a million gum trees, and nothing much else to mention. And trees don't speak more than once a week, and nobody pays any attention. Only the bush by night, with Jupiter shining clear. You can listen with all your might. This is all you'll hear. Silence. Kenneth Slessor.
Silence became the dominant aspect of the explorer's acoustic journeys in Australia. And you see this almost from the beginning. If we take the explorations of John Oxley, for example, one of the earliest explorers of the river systems of eastern Australia in 1817 and 1818. Now, Oxley goes driven by an economic imperative. He's looking for land. He's not listening to land. He's looking for land for settlement. He's disoriented by the sounds he hears because they seem so sparse and disordered. You begin to get this sort of coded oral message in his diaries that the biggest obstacle is the oral terrain to the psychological possession of Australia. And it's an obstacle because what he's hearing, apart from the occasional environmental sound, is basically silence. And the language that he uses and explorers generally use to describe silence, there's a lot of continuity in it. Dismal, gloomy, appalling, awful, death-like. So if we reflect on the words that are missing, they don't say peaceful. They don't say mysterious or astonishing. It's just incredibly gloomy and undermining for them.
The silence and solitude of this mighty waste were appalling to the mind, and I almost regretted that I had sworn to conquer it. Ernest Giles, 1874.
Sound becomes an inescapable aspect of the way they respond to much of Australia, to the point, I think, that there's a tendency to withdraw from much of the continent. In a way, sound becomes marginalised. People cling to the coast, to areas of greater fertility, to where they can hear the ocean, sounds from which they can derive a positive oral message. An equation develops between silence and space. The interior of Australia becomes a non-place, in part because it's a non-sound. I think it's no accident that the sound of waves, it's the sound of the beach, that becomes a major acoustic in Australian identity.
Arguably in the 1850s, in the just before the Civil War, there seems to be more people, more whites, who are aware of the value and the differences of black culture, who are going to the churches to listen to the blacks, who appreciate it. There seems to be a sort of a convergence of the cultures. And it's as though after, you know, over 200 years of living cheek by jowl in the South, a larger proportion of whites are suddenly aware of the culture that's produced by the people that they have enslaved for the previous two centuries.
Shouts and groans, terrific shrieks and indescribable expressions of ecstasy, of pleasure or agony, foot stamping, hand clapping, echoed through the building. My own muscles all stretched as if ready for a struggle, my face glowing, my feet stamping, having been infected unconsciously with an instinctive bodily sympathy with the excitement of the crowd.
Representations of slavery in TV series or in film tend not to do that well, but by the lights of what we've discovered researching sounds and slavery in the last 5 or 10 years. For the most part, if someone's making a film about slavery, they're perfectly happy just to put a blues track over it, which is anachronistic. People are beginning to think more about it nowadays. So, for example, there are any number of historical museums on the East Coast and in the South of America where they have reenactments. And nowadays they are incorporating sound into that. They're very keen to have people come and talk to the historical reenactors about what plantation life or what urban life sounded like and the sorts of sounds that African Americans made as they were going about their work. But that's very recent. That's very recently.
19th century America, its tensions rising into civil war, is a very different place from Australia at the same time. Yet the significance of certain sounds resonates across both. The power of silence, the sound of the other. The importance of uniformity and what to find noise. Attending to the sounds of the past might not be a ready route to answers about times gone by, but what it does offer, perhaps, is a new set of questions.
It adds texture to the past. Just as we live our lives in a full sensory capacity in which all of our senses are engaged in the world, I think it's appropriate and helpful to recognise that people in the past did too. If we don't attend to the acoustomology of the past, then we're sort of treating them as unhearing people.
What Graham White and myself and a whole bunch of other historians are trying to do is shifting history away from being about the elite. We are consciously writing about ordinary slaves, and trying to recover their history, the history of everyday life, requires a certain amount of creativity in looking at sources and using sources. But clearly, the senses as a whole, not just sound, are part of what constitutes everyday life. You can get into arguments with historians as to whether the senses, and sound in particular, or the senses generally, constitute a new field of history, and that there are many historians now who do write about this. To my way of thinking, it's not a separate field. What we're trying to do is heighten the awareness, the sonic awareness, if you will, of all historians, so that every historian who's writing about, you know, if someone's writing about Sydney in the first couple of decades, actually to consciously think at some point about what it sounded like. It just becomes part of the arsenal of tools that are available for historians when they're trying to recover the past. Because if you think about it, you know, sound is an important part of everyday lived experience.
And Odysseus climbed aboard himself, and down he lay, all quiet, as crewmen sat to the oarlocks, each in line, and the ship, like a four-horse team, careering down the plain, all breaking as one, with the whiplash cracking smartly. So the stern hove high and plunged with the seething rollers, crashing dark in her wake as she surged unwavering.
The words of Homer's Odyssey conclude today's Hindsight. Thanks to all the contributors to the program, Hearing the Past, particularly Professor Shane White from the University of Sydney. The reader was Glenda Linscott, and thanks to sound performers Cameron Fairweather, Ingrid Hayne, Manolis Mavromarkis, Michael Taft, and Class 43S, St Bridges Primary School in Mordialloc, Melbourne. Details of recent books about sound history are listed on our website at abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. Hearing the Past was produced by Jennifer Bowen, with sound production by Alex Stinson and Gary Havrillay. Next week on Hindsight, in the first of a two-part series, we're heading back to inner-city Sydney circa 1977, when punk was God, and a generation inspired by both politics and art began a groundbreaking musical movement that defied all the old boundaries. Part one of Do That Dance, Australian post-punk, next week on Hindsight. I'm Sharon Davis, and I hope you can join me then.